Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to this Friday edition of the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a multimedia look at an Arizona icon, how visual representations of the Grand Canyon shaped the American West. And we revisit our newest edition, Sam Dingman's first reporting assignment for the show, one that kept him up at night. But first, the new fiscal year starts next week, and with it, the newly approved state budget goes into effect. The spending plan closes a roughly $1.4 billion shortfall for the rest of this fiscal year and the next one. It relies on cuts across state agencies, fund sweeps, and delaying some capital projects, among other provisions. And while the budget generated bipartisan support, it also generated bipartisan opposition, both for what's in it and also for the way the process of voting on it happened. Lawmakers complained about not having input on the plan or the ability to make changes to it or not having enough time to read what was actually in it. Kevin DeMena is a longtime lobbyist at the state capitol, an observer of state government. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about how the process played out this year, and they started with how similar or different it was to what DeMena has witnessed in the past.
Well, that's a bit of an open-ended measure. What I've witnessed in the past compared to today is troubling. And you want to take a critical view, it's maybe inspirational. The budget used to be an exercise that lasted year-round. It was a privilege to be appointed to a subcommittee, which we have some of those now, of the Appropriations Committee. And then you would deliberate over your portfolio almost the entire year before the budget was introduced. The situation now is closer to speed dating, where the members ask to swipe left or right on the document when it's presented to them.
What we heard from members on both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats, who expressed a lot of frustration that not only were they not involved in the process of crafting it, but also that they were voting on it and didn't necessarily have a great sense of what was in it.
The low mark came when the Capitol community received a blizzard of texts. Some fine American, some fine Arizonan, took photos of the document, I'm going to say 20, 30 pages, that reflected the deal and shot it out to everyone. Now, what that did was first questions of process and legitimacy aside, it set the place on fire. The members, of course, don't want to learn about this in that fashion.
Yeah.
So that's the first step. At this point, acknowledging the negotiation process, it always relates to three individuals, a speaker, a president, and a governor, or their designee. It's always been thus. In this case, they were it. You often bring in the appropriations chairman, your majority leaders,
others. Other people in leadership, yeah.
Yeah, the bigger the room, the better the buy-in. So the reality is that a protracted open process eventually should lead to a product that has far more buy-in.
I'm wondering if you think that the fact that members didn't feel like they were consulted, didn't feel like they had input, didn't feel like they could make changes or ask for changes, do you think that really led to people voting against this or at least saying they were going to vote against it?
You know, ultimately, it's a transaction. Every vote, the member receives something of value. They've worked very hard to get that vote. Campaigns aren't easy. So it's a complex measure. It's never done for one simple reason. But what we witnessed was the minority leadership stepping up and engaging and really serving as an agent where some felt the governor's office hadn't. The result was better deliverables for a handful of Democrats. In the 44 years I've been doing this, there is always a hard right contingent that disavows the budget. And as a result, they disavow their influence over the budget. Depending on how many Republicans there are in the majority, that empowers some or all of the minority. This year, that's what happened from Tuesday to Saturday.
It seems like every year there is some amount of complaining about the budget process being rushed, you know, lawmakers voting at 2 in the morning on a budget, things like that. It seems, though, that like the complaining this year is maybe louder and maybe a little more intense and coming from more quarters than in the past. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I think you've described a consensus at the legislature. Happens occasionally. It's serendipity. The term for this session and what these folks across the board, staff, political observers, and the members facing information underload at every turn, if the process had slowed, documents had been produced, analysis performed, you get authentic buy-in. And what a wonderful motivation that is to go to the floor with that.
Well, it's interesting because we saw, for example, in one of the appropriations committees, members were not allowed to explain their votes. They voted on the package of bills as opposed to each individual. You know, budget committees in the past have run hours and hours because there's lots of stakeholders, lots of constituents who, you know, have their interests that are either funded or not funded in the budget. This year did not seem that way. This year, the committee meetings were relatively quick. Debate was relatively quick. And as you pointed out, the timeline was also relatively quick.
I'm not sure if you were designing this as a corporation that you would run it that way. So it's important to remember, you know, I want Arizona government to run like a business. So the necessity of gathering input is – it leads – directly and undeniably to a superior product. So this year, the low ebb of input is, I think, what's catching the most attention. Rule 14G was implemented in the House in the last few weeks, which surprisingly to the members in the hearing, prohibited them from explaining their vote in committee. It's not an accident. Arizona, in law, arguably in the Constitution, exempts its legislature from the open meeting law. For me, I think it's time to do away with that. The sunshine aspect of this, members should be able to access everything in the process, and the citizens, the folks that want to engage, shouldn't have to come down from Holbrook to do that. We're at kind of a crossroads. I feel it. I think the others feel the pressure as well.
So let's look ahead then to next year. We, of course, don't know who's going to control the legislature, Democrats or Republicans. We know that Governor Hobbs will still be there. We know that House Speaker Ben Thoma will not be there because he's running for Congress. We assume that Senate President Peterson will at least be in the legislature, if not Senate President. So do you have any measure of hope that things might be different next time?
I'm a big believer in this sort of evolutionary change. This is a self-aware group. In politics, they want to understand what they're doing, and they want to understand – they want the public to understand it. President Warren Peterson has a great deal of experience in this. I have every reason to believe he'll come back as the Senate president.
Assuming Republicans control
Assuming Republicans control that chamber. Katie Hobbs isn't going anywhere. The House, it's going to be a reboot. But that dissatisfaction that we've been discussing, I think it's strongest there. So the traction for these structural reforms is going to come with the next legislature. I like to use this little ditty, which is every now and then the hamster needs to get off the wheel, write a memo, evaluate the function of the wheel, get some new parts, then get back on and do better. We haven't updated this process in decades. And in fact, if you equate public input with quality product, and by public I mean smart lawyers and school teachers from Snowflake, if you equate those two things, we need a lot more sunshine and a lot more engagement, which will slow it down. It will open it up. But the product, the resulting law, it won't just be better law. It will better reflect what the voters of these districts want.
Yeah, interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is longtime lobbyist Kevin DiMatta with DiMatta Public Affairs. Kevin, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
The Grand Canyon is much more than a place. It is an icon, an idea that's woven into the fabric of American identity. And our next guest analyzed hundreds of images of it to explore what that icon means. Yolanda Youngs is the author of the new book, Framing Nature, The Creation of an American Icon at the Grand Canyon, out earlier this month. In it, she looks at maps, artifacts, postcards, photographs, and more to find out how visual interpretations of the Grand Canyon have shaped the American West. But there was a time when people viewed it as valueless. I spoke with Youngs more about it.
There was a time when the Grand Canyon was considered valueless, and that is more of a reference to ideas in the late 19th, early 20th century that places that could not be harvested for timber resources or mineral resources or all important agriculture and farming, those were just valueless places. Mm. And so the Grand Canyon, you know, it's obviously arid, it's high desert, water's difficult to get to in the desert, and, you know, it's a tough place to farm. And the turning point that happens is this movement in, you know, across the country, but particularly centered around the National Parks movement, that value might come from the scenic and perhaps even sort of the spiritual or intellectual merits of a place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Thoreau, and certainly the early National Park Service director, Stephen Mather, really encouraged thinking about these places as places that need to be protected and that had great value because of their beauty.
So, I mean, coming from a place in which the Grand Canyon was considered valueless in this way, and then looking at the way we see it today, there's quite a gap there. And I don't think we can understate how valueful, I guess, we see the Grand Canyon today, right? Like, it is iconic in so many ways. And you're tracking that kind of metamorphosis in this book. You do this through a variety of things. You have illustrations and postcards, film, maps, much more. So tell us, you know, what are some of the earliest images or imagery that you found of the Grand Canyon?
The book is full of imagery because, as you're saying, that's part of my tracing of these changing ideas about the canyon is looking at it visually and, very important as well, spatially. So there's over 140 photographs, illustrations, and maps in the book. And some of the earliest work, I trace it back to early Anglo and European exploration of the region. And if we go back, you know, as I did, I looked at maps from, say, the Dominguez and Escalante exploration of 1776, and some of those sort of earlier maps that were, you know, there's not a lot on that page, quite frankly. You know, there were some attempts to find the canyon and to explore it in a certain extent, but really not much until we get to sort of that era in the 1860s and 70s of river exploration. And so, you know, this is part of what I found intriguing is that early views, if you will, and a lot of these are like woodblock prints and sometimes became sketches or paintings. Thomas Moran's, there's a great woodblock print called Noonday Rest at Marble Canyon. And the view is absolutely at the river level, looking up into the incredible expanse of the Grand Canyon. But that look of the river looking up is quite different from that, you know, rimside view, which is what I found in the hundreds of images I went through. I went through more than 1,000 images in this book for the data. Yeah. So it was kind of interesting to see the early views were very much from the river, and then it started to shift up to the rim.
So, I mean, you've talked about the Grand Canyon as two things, right? Like at the same time, a real place as well as an abstraction, right? And there are a lot of layers to that. But tell us, first of all, what do you mean by that? Like, how is it both of these things? And in what ways is it an abstraction?
Yeah, well, part of that abstract idea is the parts of the Grand Canyon that shape what geographers and some scholars call our popular idea of the Grand Canyon. And that is something that derives from imagery and from descriptions and oftentimes things that we have seen or read that other people have recorded. So, you know, many of your listeners have probably been to the Grand Canyon. I'm sure most of them have seen some sort of image of the Grand Canyon. But if you close your eyes, even if you haven't been to the Grand Canyon, you have an idea what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I started to write this book, I would ask people, you know, have you been to the Grand Canyon? What did you do there? Okay, if you haven't been to it, you know, what have you seen of it? And very frequently people would say, yeah, you know, if I close my eyes and think about it, I see, you know, the canyon, I'm standing on the rim, I'm looking across, there's this vast horizon, I could see a big blue sky, and then I could see this really deep canyon in front of me. And, you know, that comes from experience, that comes from images we've seen, but it also comes from the thousands and thousands of images over 100 plus years that have shown us very specific places in the canyon and very specific views.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you lastly, Yolanda, about sort of the myths that this all contributes to, right? Like, as you're saying, like, if the Grand Canyon is this abstract idea as much as it is a real place in kind of American mythology and Western mythology, do you think that's a good thing, or how do you see its role?
Yeah, well, you know, it is a place that is outsized in many ways. You know, it is an icon, but it is so incredibly influential in terms of environmental management and policy ideas, not just for the park or even for that region, but, you know, nationally extensive. And, you know, it kind of connects to a couple of my big takeaways from the book that, you know, thinking about the Grand Canyon, we need to consider place. Place is very important here. It's to think about an environmentally sustainable and climate resilient future for the canyon relies on understanding it in a regional context, understanding it has incredibly rich biodiversity. It's a multicultural place and has been for a long time. It is a place that experiences climate regimes that we need to appreciate as well, especially as we move forward. And importantly, you know, it's a place that we can look to think about things like water resources as we move through, you know, our climate future. So, you know, how we see the Grand Canyon is really important to how we perceive it, what we use of it, and our expectations about it. And those things translate into decisions. Those could be policy decisions. Those could be the ways we decide to go and visit the Grand Canyon or use it. Mm-hmm. Or even if we don't see the Grand Canyon, it's important to think about what this icon of American landscape might mean to us.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Yolanda Youngs, Associate Professor at California State University, San Bernardino, in the Department of Geography and Environmental Studies. She's author of the new book, Framing Nature. Yolanda, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for talking to us about this.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Enjoyed the interview.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the latest essay in our soapbox series, Clowning Around at Summer Camp. But first, Phoenix is the ultimate drive-through town. In fact, Arizona was home to the very first McDonald's drive-through in 1975 in Sierra Vista. Today, they are everywhere, from Starbucks to the Dutch Bros phenomenon to the popularity of places like Salad and Go. And of course, there are your fast food joints. There's drive-up grocery pickup and a few drive-through liquor stores left, too. I get it. They're easier, they're faster, you don't have to get out of your car in the summer heat. The list of pluses goes on. But I wondered, is there also something lost in all of this convenience? So to find out more, I turned to someone who knows a lot about communication, the director of the Hugh Downs School of Human Communication at ASU, Dr. Sarah Tracy. Last September, she told me there are two parts to communicating, the task at hand and the relationship behind it. Here's more.
The thing that comes to mind is that more and more we have these ways to communicate that focuses on the task of communication, but it leaves out a lot of the richness of the relationship that we can get when we are interacting with people and in an embodied way.
Hmm. Tell us more about that. Like, what do you think is lost in that? Like, when we don't have this kind of face-to-face opportunity for communication?
Yeah, so in our Communication 101 classes, we teach that communication has both the task and the relationship part. The relationship part is the social connection that we get. So if we order online or if we order through a drive-thru, it might actually be even better at the task than if we are with the person and we are flirting or chatting and laughing and joking and so on. But we miss all of that feeling of connection with others, which really gives us a lot of happiness and actually is also connected to our health.
Interesting. How is it connected to our health? Sounds like there's been research on that.
Yeah, I teach a course at ASU called Communication and the Art of Happiness. And when we look at the happiest people in the world, they are people that have rich social lives. They surround themselves not only with those close ties like family members, but also interact regularly with a community of others. And so when we reduce how much we have in terms of community connection, and when I say they're happier, they're also healthier. And so this does make a difference in terms of our physical and our mental well-being.
It almost is like the meet cute thing that happens in romantic comedies. Like that can't happen in a drive-thru in the same way, right?
Right. And, you know, when we reduce being able to interact with people as full people and it's just focused on, does this pizza have the right toppings? Does my coffee have the right number of shots of coffee in it? That's no longer there.
Yeah. So we're also in this moment, Sarah, in which our society, I think, is more divisive than it has been, at least in a long time. There seems to be pretty good agreement on that politically and culturally as well. Like the divisions are more apparent. Do you think this kind of thing, this kind of isolation in our cars, on our phones, waiting in a drive-thru line, as opposed to having to be with real people inside a store, for example, does that contribute to this?
It certainly can. I spent some of the summer in London, and every day I was literally physically rubbing up to other people like on the sidewalk or brushing their arm or being nearby them when I'm in the tube and so on. And it reminds us that even if somebody, for instance, is reading a book or has a magazine that has a different political ideology, we all have something in common, and we're all able to see how we need to work with one another in order to do something, even if it's as simple as how do we work together to get into this elevator or to get where we need to go in peace. And if you think about cars and the way that we interact with people in cars in Phoenix, a lot of people interact with cars as though they are things rather than actually people. And so we can engage in behavior that we would never engage with if we had to see another person's expression. And I sometimes think about times where someone might be really aggressive on the roadway, but then once they catch up with someone at a stoplight, they're embarrassed to look at the other person. And it's because all of a sudden they're like, oh my goodness, I actually acted in a way that I wouldn't want to act if I had to see their face.
Right. It like strips away the humanity in a way.
Yeah. They're just like little bombs on the freeway rather than people.
So we're being very negative about this, I feel. Is there anything that's gained in this? Like, is there maybe an opportunity to find this community in different ways or in a different kind of setting?
Yeah, sure, of course. So one of the things that is important to realize is that mediated communication, whether it's at the drive-thru or whether it's online or whatever, that is not an enemy, but it's a tension that we're in where we need to think about what is it that I'm able to get from this venue of communicating and what is missing from it. And so oftentimes the task can be done more efficiently with less, you know, transportation costs and so on because we're able to talk online, talk from afar, etc. But if you find yourself in a space where you're feeling unconnected or you're feeling increasingly divided or lonely, I would recommend that you take a look at the venues of your conversations and communication and the balance of them. Mm-hmm. Are there ways that you can take a walk and actually see other people? Does it make sense to knock on your neighbor's door rather than texting them when you have a message for them?
Forcing yourself almost to be in situations where you'll physically see other people feels fair. So you mentioned something about loneliness. Tell me a little bit about how that might connect and how being in our cars or just sort of separated from each other physically could contribute to that kind of thing.
Sure. Well, loneliness is a key part of suffering, and most people do not clearly communicate that they're suffering when they are in mediated spaces in a real literal way. The way that we recognize that people are suffering typically is through emotional leakage through their nonverbals. Hmm. So we see someone and we're able to notice that they're suffering, and it's through that that we're able then to reach out and actually practice some compassion. And when we think about, for instance, not only this topic that we're talking about, the car culture, but also the effects of COVID, It's no wonder that there were more suffering people, more loneliness and so on, because we literally just did not know. And we cannot know as well that somebody is hurting when we're not with them. And if we don't know that they're hurting, it's harder for us to practice compassion.
Will there, do you think, Sarah, be a backlash to this? Like, do you anticipate our societies becoming more and more insular in this way and finding more and more ways to maybe break out of that and maybe finding some cool new things that come out of that?
Possibly. I'm hopeful that there are people that are more and more realizing some of the things that they're missing when they don't have that embodied communication. However, we do tend to go with the thing that seems most immediately easy. And the lack of friction with other people in terms of ordering food, in terms of not having to deal with the emotional fallout of sending a certain text message like we might have to if we were face to face, it can be very tempting. And so what I try to do when I'm teaching students at ASU about this is really to help them understand through doing activities where they are in conversation and they journal about it, and they are able to better realize, like, wow, this actually brought me a lot of happiness and a lot of connection and so on by doing these activities that they might, their default might be to do it in a mediated way, to do it in a more embodied way.
Yeah. All right. Some good advice to end on. Dr. Sarah Tracy, director of the Hugh Downs School of Human Communication at ASU, joining us to talk more about this drive-through culture. Dr. Tracy, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for your expertise here. I appreciate it.
Of course. It's been great. Thank you.
This spring, we added a new member to our team here at the show. Sam Dingman is a reporter who moved here from New York City, and he filed his first story for the show in March. As you're about to hear, Sam's adjustment to life in the Valley has been a bit of an adventure.
I'm embarrassed to admit this, but ever since I moved to Arizona, I've been sleeping with the light on. It all started one night back in Brooklyn a few weeks before I got here. I was laying on my couch, scanning various Phoenix housing subreddits, which, in retrospect, was a terrible idea. Every flick of my thumb seemed to bring up another story about a harrowing nocturnal encounter with an exotic desert pest. Roof rats, scorpions, snakes. At some point, I realized I was taking very shallow breaths. I shivered and I threw my phone across the room. But it was too late. I could feel my eyelids twitching. I lay down in bed, and I tossed and turned for hours. It seemed like my fate was inevitable. My future apartment was definitely infested. If I so much as dared to shut my eyes, something sinister was going to slither out of the shadows and get me. The moment I got here, I went to Target, and I bought a bedside lamp with an 80-watt bulb. And as the sun went down on my first night in Phoenix, I pulled the bed sheets up to my chin, scanned the corners of the room for movement, and wondered if I am cut out for life in the desert. Okay.
You
make our way in?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. We can just come over to the gate right here.
Okay. I had lived in Phoenix for about 48 hours when the show's executive producer, Amy Silverman, gave me my first assignment, a visit to the Phoenix Herpetological Sanctuary. I ducked back to my desk and subtly Googled herpetology and then did my best to suppress the telltale twitch. Herpetology, the study of reptiles. I took a shallow breath, grabbed my recording kit, and drove up to Scottsdale with producer Amber Victoria Singer. As we pulled into the parking lot, our tour guide for the afternoon, Michael Ring, greeted us with an eager wave.
Animals. We have over 1,500 animals here. Giant snakes. We'll go to the venomous snake hall when we check out the rattlesnakes. But yeah, there's a lot.
This will be my first time in a venomous snake hall.
Yeah. No, it's very cool. And this is an impressive venomous snake hall. We have,
Michael is an affable 20-something with curly brown hair and a perpetual grin. As he gestured towards the venomous snake hall, I noticed a pair of giant silver bands on his fingers.
My name is Michael Ring, so I like wearing rings. I think it's my namesake, so I should be wearing a ring.
One of the rings was shaped like an eagle. The other was a yin-yang symbol, which Michael referred to as the Tao.
And I'd consider myself a Taoist, in a way, a sage.
Michael also considers himself a reptile enthusiast, or, as he puts it, a herper.
Snake identification is just fun to learn in general, you know? Us herpers, we're basically like birders with snakes, you know? We like going out and documenting these animals in the wild, and it's a hobby that I'd recommend anyone to try.
As it happened, Michael had been doing some herping just before we arrived.
I actually did a snake relocation at a local home only 2 miles away.
That same morning, the Herpetological Sanctuary had gotten a call from a panicked Valley resident who had discovered a pair of rattlesnakes in her living room. By the time Michael got there, the snakes had vanished. He eventually found them hiding near the washing machine. He told us it was a good thing he got there before something bad happened to the snakes.
Honestly, here in Arizona, there's a lot of people that go the route of killing snakes that they find on their property. In many instances, it just comes out of indiscriminate fear.
I couldn't help noticing Michael used the phrase indiscriminate fear as he led us into the aforementioned venomous snake hall. We walked past rows of display cases containing various snakes, and towards the back of the room, there was a separate area behind thick paned glass, accessible only by punching a code into a keypad. A tall, soft-spoken man in thick black boots emerged from this secure area and smiled.
My name is Cale Morris. I'm the venom manager for the Phoenix Herpetological Sanctuary, and I've actually worked here for 20 years.
Is that a rattlesnake rattle pendant around your neck?
Yeah, it's made out of brass.
Okay.
But it's my lucky rattlesnake necklace. I wear it every day.
Like Michael, Cale worries about people who panic when they encounter rattlesnakes.
I've personally ran into a lot of people that have been bit trying to move a rattlesnake or trying to kill them.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just cutting their heads off, some people do. And there was a guy, he cut the head of a rattlesnake off, and he said it didn't move for a long time, and he put it in his pocket, but then it bit him in his pocket. And so
the severed head of the snake bit him from
the
pocket.
At the time, a lot of people were asking us questions like, how is this possible? And I said, well,
that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, the whole venom apparatus is in the head. And when you cut off an animal's head like that, you know, neurons are firing. It's actually worse.
One day, a friend of Cale's was on a hike, and he stepped on a rattlesnake. When the snake didn't bite, Cale got an idea. Maybe he could put together an experiment that would prove his theory that rattlesnakes are less dangerous than most people think. All he needed to do was replicate his friend's experience. So Cale told his wife about this idea.
I said, I want to step on rattlesnakes. I got a new idea. And she actually said, what is wrong with you? That's the worst idea. And I was like, yeah, you're right.
But Cale was undeterred. If he couldn't step on rattlesnakes with his own 2 feet, he would settle for the next best thing.
I have a fake leg right here that I step on rattlesnakes with.
Kale's so-called fake leg is actually a metal rod wrapped in denim with a boot at the bottom, which Kale later confirmed is the same size as his actual boot.
So when this is coming up towards the rattlesnake, they see the pants and the foot, and it looks like my leg is stepping on them.
Kale started taking the fake leg with him on hikes. And whenever he came upon a rattlesnake, he would, very carefully, step on it.
And then I'd record their behavior. I mean, I recorded their rattling. I recorded their tongue flicking. I recorded everything they did. Uh-huh. And then I gathered that data.
By Kale's count, he stepped on 175 rattlesnakes, and only 6 attacked the fake leg, a little under 4%.
I tell people they're chickens, they're scaredy cats. They want nothing to do with us. And so a lot of that research is used to help show that.
Kale's conviction was evident, but Michael seemed to sense that Amber and I weren't convinced.
Are we able to have a look at those 2 snakes for my relocation?
Sure. Cool. We just have to lock the doors.
Yes.
Are these like native?
So we have to lock ourselves in here with the snakes.
So tourists don't come in unexpectedly.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
So I will grab them and come right back out here.
Okay.
Cool.
And with that, Kale punched a passcode into the keypad and ducked into the secure area behind the glass. A moment later, he came back carrying a long pair of tongs and a big white bucket.
So this is one of our venomous snake buckets. We drill holes into it for air ventilation. And then additionally, these are equipped with a specialty lid that screws in. We do this so that, you know, the snake is securely inside of the bucket and, you know, we never have to worry about it getting out in transit if perhaps the bucket is jostled.
Yes. And if I'm clocking this, are we about to open that lid?
Yeah, so I'm going to open it. You can, you know, I'm going to keep them in the bucket with my tongs if they start to come out.
Okay.
Yeah.
The twitch was palpable, but I stirred up my courage and peered over the rim of the bucket. A pair of coiled brown serpents met my gaze.
See how they're tongue flicking? They're trying to figure out what we are. If we're a threat, they're scared. If I touch them or move them, they'll probably start to rattle.
There we go. The rattling is just them saying, I'm scared. What's going on here?
Kale, I'm really trying to be mindful of what you told me 5 minutes ago.
You're fine.
As I listened to the rattle, I realized how directly I've been conditioned to associate that sound with imminent death, nature's equivalent of the theme from Jaws. But as it went on, I stared at these snakes, trying to see them through Kale's eyes. And the longer I looked at them, the less they seemed like vicious mercenaries, and more like they were trying to figure out how they ended up at the bottom of a bucket. Anxious creatures with a tenuous grip on survival, abruptly relocated from their natural habitat to unfamiliar surroundings, worried they might not be safe here.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Now for part 2 of Sam's story.
Kale screwed the lid back onto the bucket, put the snakes away, and came back holding a Gila monster in his tongs. Michael explained that Gila monsters are also highly venomous, but that doesn't stop people from trying to keep them as pets, which Michael made sure to clarify is illegal.
In fact, it is illegal to perturb a Gila monster, to disrupt its path, to move it, to touch it in any way.
As the Gila monster squirmed between Kale's tongs, Michael gazed admiringly at the series of raised bumps on its skull. His voice took on a reverent tone.
They are a state treasure, so we really want them to be safe.
What do you love about them?
Oh, I love everything about them. You don't even get me started. Here's a couple things.
Michael proceeded to give us a laundry list of things that he appreciates about both Gila monsters and rattlesnakes.
The keeled scales and the ornate eye color and just hearing that deafening sound of that keratin rattle.
In other words, everything about reptiles that seems alienating and ominous to me, those are Michael's favorite things.
I have a pet ball python, and she's the sweetest thing in the world. She has never bitten me, and I've had her for 12 years. And
what's her name?
Boaz. And the funny thing is that, you know, that's a way better track record than most people's dogs.
Once again, Kale emerged from the secure venom room, where he had spent the last few minutes gazing lovingly into the various snake pens.
They can't hear you, you know, when we talk to them because they have no ears, but we do. You know, we talk to them and it's like, how you doing? You know, because it's, I just am fascinated by snakes. I mean, something that looks like it shouldn't be able to survive with no arms, no legs. It seems like it has all these weaknesses, but it thrives.
Speaking of survival, Amber and I made it out of the venomous snake hall, unscathed. Michael walked us back to the parking lot.
Venom manager.
My big takeaway so far that venom manager is the best job title ever and the best legal status ever is for it to be illegal to be perturbed.
Yeah, that's actually great. I love that. Yeah. If only there was a way to get that for a person, right? Yeah.
Maybe there is. Ever since my visit to the Phoenix Herpetological Sanctuary, I've been thinking about one of the last things Michael Ring said to us.
People see us as almost superhuman in the sense that we're able to interact with these animals that would otherwise be perceived as dangerous. But the real truth behind that illusion is that we just understand these animals and we understand that when you work within the parameters of their behavior and you meet them where they're at, you can get a lot done. So,
wow.
Would you agree with that, Kale?
Yeah. Sure.
It's pretty. It's pretty profound.
Thank you.
It's pretty profound.
Yeah.
Last night, I lay down in bed, reached over to the nightstand, and gingerly switched off my lamp. I don't know if I will ever be a herper, but I'm going to try to be a little less perturbed.
It's a lifestyle. It's entirely a lifestyle, being a reptile person. You know?
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Cornhole, relay races, swimming contests, games are a classic part of the summer camp experience. Today, we conclude our latest series of soapbox essays with the story of a different kind of game. Tempe writer and performer Kim Porter explains.
Creative envy is my driving force. No matter what artistic activity I'm currently doing, if I see someone somewhere doing some other artistic activity, I'll immediately feel sorry for myself. Why can't I do that? Nobody triggers that envy more than Jasper Starfire. I met Jasper in 1994 when I ran the costume shop at Camp Winter Rainbow, a circus camp in the woods of Northern California. Jasper taught drama and art. Every day I'd stand in the costume barn peering over the rack of clown suits as Jasper improvised for the kids. He was tall with floppy blonde hair, a booming laugh, and a Tom Hanksian charm. I wanted to be Jasper, or at least be like him. I was reacquainted with Jasper in 2013 when I returned to camp after a 17-year hiatus. He was old now, like me, married with kids of his own, but somehow even more enviable. Jasper walked through camp like a visiting prince, an entourage of 10-year-olds tugging at his sleeves. I get it. When Jasper shines his attention on you, it feels like you've been invited to the ball. Once, while walking up the dirt road to the kitchen, I came upon him, wearing a name tag that read Listening Tour. I said, "Why are you on a listening tour?" He pulled out a notepad and he wrote, "Laryngitis." I said, "How do you do that? How do you always find the game?" And he wrote, "If you can't fix it, feature it." Why can't I figure out how to feature envy? Over the years, I cultivated a friendship with Jasper. We were both early risers, and we'd meet at the kitchen to supervise the campers as they played board games before breakfast. One morning, as Jasper and I sat sipping coffee, I noticed two girls playing the game Who's Who, and I got excited. Who's Who is a game for two players in which each player tries to guess the other player's mystery person by asking only yes or no questions. Each player has a plastic tray with about 20 tiny hinged frames. Inside of each frame is a cartoon face. There's an additional deck of cards with all the same faces, and the players draw a card from that deck and they keep it secret. When it's your turn, you can ask questions like, is your person a man? Is he wearing a hat? Does he have a mustache? And if your opponent says no, then you flip down all the frames with all the men who do have hats and mustaches. Thus, turn by turn, you eliminate the wrong faces until you have just one face left. I said to Jasper, I like to play that game, but instead of asking things you can see, I like to ask things you can only feel, like, has your person been to France, or are they scared of dogs? Jasper looked intrigued. Can you guess the right person doing that? No, it never works. I'd like to try that, he said. I felt elated. Jasper liked my idea. On the last morning of camp, as Jasper and I were cleaning up the games while the kids headed to breakfast, I said, "Want to play Who's Who?" He said, "Sure." I was thrilled, but scared. What if I'd oversold it? We each drew our secret person from the deck. I drew Frank. "Is your person late with their child support payments?" I asked. No. I flipped down the guys who seemed like they might be late with their child support. Jasper asked, "Do they live in their mom's basement?" Not anymore. Jasper flipped a few frames. I asked, "Do they call their mom Mother?" We played like this for about 15 minutes with a mounting sense of urgency, seeing as we were actively shirking our supervisory duties. "Are they allergic to eggs? Do they hoard cats? Are they writing a novel?" I got down to one remaining face. Here goes, I thought. "Is your person Victor?" Jasper's eyes flashed as he showed me his card. Victor. Neither of us could believe that I'd guessed correctly. It felt like a miracle. Jasper said, "Was your person Frank?" I showed Jasper my card. Frank. Tears of joy stung my eyes. To look into Jasper's face, knowing that something ridiculous and sublime, a perfect once-in-a-lifetime moment, had transpired between us, was perhaps the greatest victory of my life. I am like Jasper, after all. But more importantly, Jasper is like me.
The day we left it all, we looked beyond the veil as we went way into the world.
That was Tempe writer and performer Kim Porter. You can hear all of the essays in our Summer Camp Soapbox series and learn how you can tell your own story on air on our website. That is theshow.kjzz.org.
Tried to capture photographs, but none could ever catch the dream my eyes had seen.
All right, that'll do it for today's Friday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again on Monday morning with much more. And if you want to keep up with the show, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
The rays and shadows cast magnificent displays on